finding that we are not alone, we change radically the way us humans see ourselves.
Podcast number 3 in the series on other worlds, I speak with Frank Marchis. Frank is a planetary astronomer at the SETI Institute and the CSO at Unistellar. And Frank starts the conversation today with some of the real-time stats in the search for other worlds, such as numbers of planets and numbers of stars that really shine a light on our place in the universe. We also discuss astronomical research itself and how things like citizen science can really bolster this pursuit. And lastly, Frank reflects on some of the philosophical and societal effects that looking at the stars really has. And importantly, one of Frank's goals is to really make astronomy accessible. So please, if you're interested in any sort of viewing or finding out more, check out the company Unistellar for telescopes or go to SETI to find out more information on what we talked about today.
Mind-bending chemicals.
I don't care. He wants to kill me.
I'm as mad as hell and I'm not going to take this anymore!
Our universe has roughly 3 trillion galaxies. So that's a big number. And someone asked me, what is 3 trillion? And I found out on the web, because you find everything on the web, that 3 trillion is basically the number of trees you have on Earth.
Wow.
So that gives you an idea of the number of galaxies. So you can kind of have an idea of that, right?
Mm-hmm.
3 trillion galaxies, that's a lot. We obviously did not count all of them one per one.
Mm-hmm.
One day someone got a very crazy idea. And that's this person is was a director of the space telescopes at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, when you're director of a facility like that, you have what we call discretionary time, director discretionary time. So that's time you can use for yourself or for other people. And he decided that he's gonna use this time in collaboration with other people to look at an empty patch of the sky, like an area where there is nothing, no stars, nothing. And did he do that for a week or 10 days at the time. And they opened the eyes of the Hubble Space Telescope, the most expensive telescope at the time, that was in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And they observed this patch of the sky continuously almost, taking into account the rotation of the satellite around Earth. And they discovered that, in fact, this patch of the sky was not empty. In fact, there was a lot of galaxies in it. Tiny, tiny galaxy, very distant. And by counting them, that's what astronomers love to do. They count things and then they extrapolate. We reach this magical number of 3 trillion galaxies.
Uh-huh.
So that's a big number.
It's a huge number.
Yeah. And then we kind of, let's think about just our Milky Way, our own galaxy, which is kind of not too big, not too small. It's not very... a significantly different galaxy compared to the others we know around us. There is 400 billion stars in our galaxy. So that's roughly the same number of neurons you have in the brain of an elephant. That's not a good number, a good comparison, because nobody has any idea about this. But that's the number I found. So I say, when I say 400 billion, people say 200 billion. You will see a lot of different numbers. We are launching, we have launched the Gaia spacecraft recently, and this one is basically give us a good map of the stars in our galaxy. So we will know more soon of the exact number of stars in our galaxy. But that's already a very big number.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
when people look at the star, they don't see stars only, of course. When you look at the sky, you see tiny dots, which are stars, but in fact, you are seeing planets. And those planets, they're in orbit around the star. So you don't see them, but you are watching those systems, those planetary systems. And there is an average 2 planets per star in our galaxy. So let's say 400, 800 billion. Okay. So that was basically the conversation I think we had in July.
Right.
2019. We talked about that.
Mm-hmm.
And but since then, a lot happened. And one of the things that happened, which I think is the most significant scientific result in astronomy of the year 2020, and I'm very careful when I say that, is the finalization of the Kepler catalog. Mm-hmm. So Kepler is the spacecraft that look a patch of the sky from 2009 to 2013, trying to detect attenuation of a star due to the presence of a planet in orbit around mm-hmm. it, right? And by analyzing this this area over 4 years, astronomers discover thousands of exoplanets. Mm-hmm. And that's the way we know that there is, in average, two planets in orbit around right. each star in our galaxy. But more interestingly, after finalizing this catalog and counting the planet, estimating the size of the star, the brightness of the stars, etc., they made this kind of analysis. And the statistical analysis gave an extraordinary result. The statistical analysis showed that there is at least 300 million potentially habitable worlds in our galaxy. So what does that mean, potentially habitable worlds? That's a technical term that we use because we want right. to be very careful.
Uh-huh.
Those are planets which are almost the same size as Earth, so terrestrial, okay? Not too big, not too small, not gas giant, which are located in the habitable zone of the star. So mm-hmm. where you could expect to get liquid water if the planet has the same kind of atmosphere than our planet.
Mm-hmm.
So that's 300 million worlds that could have liquid water, ocean, and you name it, river, etc.
Mm-hmm.
So this is an extraordinary result because the number is big. It's seriously right. a huge number. And it's a magical number because it basically gives us kind of an idea that if we know that life appeared on Earth very quickly as soon mm-hmm. we had liquid water. If you, right. you look at the evolution of our planet, shortly after the formation of the planet, when it started cooling down and we start having ponds of water mixed with the volcanic activity, the radiation, etc., despite this totally inexploitable environment, mm-hmm. we had the formation of life. We don't really know the process, but we discover life which is extremely old, formed so shortly after the formation, after the appearance of water on our planet. Mm-hmm. So as an astronomer, I'm excited by this number because it may imply that there is life everywhere in our galaxy, because those 300 million potentially habitable worlds could be basically some kind of laboratory that where life is basically thriving or has appeared and maybe has disappeared. We will right. see that.
You know, it's funny, since the last time we spoke, and great memory there as well, and anyone listening should definitely go back and listen to that episode. There was, I want to say, two main points from the last time that we spoke that I got like so many messages or something about, and one of them was just basically what you were talking about there, the sheer number of things. The other one was the idea that I had never heard of, and you had mentioned, of this sort of like Christmas tree theory about, you're talking about time in the universe as well as the number, and civilizations can pop up and disappear. And I had so many people messaging me telling me how they were basically losing sleep over these two facts. So you did a good job there. And one thing, I guess, coming off from what you were saying there too, and I spoke with Lewis about this, the astrobiologist I previously spoke to. He kind of, to me, it kind of raises this contradiction, because we often hear a lot of different things about life, either on Earth or in space in the universe. And one of these contradictions is that life is really special and difficult to begin. Earth is a very special place. We've heard the phrase the Goldilocks zone a ton of times before. Earth is very unique. But at the same time, as an astronomer, when you're finding these gargantuan numbers, suddenly it's kind of this contradiction. Maybe Earth isn't that special. So when you are actually doing this research, which way does the research pull you? on one hand, it could pull you and maybe make you think that Earth is not that special because mm-hmm. there are so many things similar to us. However, at the same time, it's not obvious there are life there. So given the fact there is so many Earth-like planets, does that mean Earth is even more special as a result of it?
That's the question we all want to be able right. to answer. My intuition, because we also have intuition, even if you're mm-hmm. a scientist, is that there is probably a lot of habitable planets in our galaxy. There's a lot of places where we have liquid water and ponds and mm-hmm. Microbes, so stuff like that floating around, algae, etc. I'm saying that because life on Earth was very simple for a very, very long time.
Right.
Okay. It's only to 800 million years ago that life diversified and became multicellular and grew in diversity, and we reached then animals like us or even like complex animals and then intelligence. Mm-hmm. So I will say that I'm betting that we will, as soon as we start pointing telescopes to our planets and detect those habitable planets, we will see signature in the atmosphere that will suggest there is some life, some mm-hmm. macrobiological life,
mm-hmm.
or they were possibly mm-hmm. too. But then the leap between this and complex biosphere like we have on Earth, that's something difficult because you need stability, you need a system which is not regulate itself. And in fact, there is a paper, another big interesting paper that was published also this year, maybe in February this year, or maybe mm-hmm. last year in December, by Toby Taro, where he basically run an experiment. And this mm-hmm. is the paper that I love because this is a thing I really would love to do, where he created millions of planets in a model, in the climate model, right? Mm-hmm. Million of Earths. And he slightly made some catastrophic events in it, like a super volcano, a gigantic, an impact of an asteroid, etc. And he look what happened, how the system destabilized and how they came back to some of them to become habitable again. And the result of his paper is that Earth is a very special place because the likeliness of having life for over 4 billion years, of being habitable, sorry, over 4 billion years, despite those catastrophic events that we know happen, it's very small. And that's something that I think we will find when we'll be able to look around planets. We will find a lot of places where life appear and disappear because of a super volcano, because of a supernova explosion, because of activity of the sun, etc. Earth was is very special because of that, because of the stability. It's sad, but I think that's what we are going to find.
Yeah. So there's this massive step between single cellular life or simple life. To what we have, and potentially even an extra step being that Earth is an extra step more safer, something along those lines, and potentially less fragile as well, which, I mean, is fortunate for us, but maybe not so fortunate for the pursuit of trying to find life elsewhere.
Yeah.
And one other thing too, so we've talked about I guess some of the numbers and some of the things that are going through your mind when you're doing any of this research. Now, the other thing that I think is quite hard for people to get their head around, especially if they've never even potentially looked through a telescope and had that kind of feeling, is how an astronomer like yourself actually makes any sort of plan, any sort of path to a goal when the sky is so big, and keeping in mind Earth is definitely three-dimensional, we have directions all around the Earth. When the sky is so big, and like you were mentioning before, when we're talking about the number of planets, you can just find a tiny black spot in the sky that seemingly has nothing, and it's filled with many, many different things.
Mm-hmm.
How do you actually create a somewhat astronomical plan on what you're going to search for, why you're going to search in that area, and how do you do it when, you know, you obviously have a limited team?
That's a very good question, and that's one of the problems we have now. It's to kind of organize our search program, such as to become coherent and provide information even if you don't find anything. So I'm going to give you a few examples. One of the examples is the GPI, the Gemini Planet Imager program. It's an instrument on the 8-meter class telescope that's capable of imaging Jupiter-sized exoplanets. Super young, though, very young one. Not like the our Jupiter, but something like less than 100 million years old. So what we did to find those Jupiter-sized exoplanets, we look around in our galaxy, where are the young stars? And are they observable with our instrument? Because we have some limitation. We first in the southern hemisphere, and we have sensitivity limitation. So we had a huge list of thousands of objects. And then we basically decided, okay, we're going to stop observing if they're beyond, I forgot the number, but something like 100 light years, 150 light years, to maximize the chance of detecting this exoplanet. And the same is happening now for the next generation of space telescope. You probably heard right now in astronomy, we are doing what we call the Astrophysics Decadal Survey, which is a way to kind of, in the US, to give direction to the research. So in part of this decadal survey, there is the definition of the science priority and also the technological priorities. And one of them is to build a great observatory. That's the term that we use by NASA in the 2030s. So not that far away.
No.
And there is multiple projects possible. There is LUVOIR, which is a gigantic 11-15 meter telescope that will build in space. There is ORIGIN, which is a mid-infrared telescope that will be able to see the heat coming from those terrestrial planets. And there is, I know it's a fourth one, but I'm not going to mention that because it's an X-ray, but the third one I was involved with is the ABEX, the Habitable Exoplanet Observatory, which is a 4-meter class telescope with this kind of panel, flower panel in front, that can cool detect Earth-like exoplanet. And so for this instrument, for this telescope, we have been defining the size of the aperture, the type of of instrument we want, and we use the science. So we basically know, I make up an example here, we basically say, okay, there is 50 stars which are bright enough and close enough to be observed by this instrument and this telescope. So now, how long we need to observe this system to detect the potential habitable planets around it? It will take 10 hours if the aperture is this size, 100 hours if the aperture is smaller. Based on this, what kind of information you want? So we collect information from various people. We invite astrobiologists are going to tell us, well, I really want to do mid-infrared.
Right.
I really want to do visible because I want to see this line, etc. So we build the instruments around that, around the scientific goal by collecting inputs from people. And then if one day ABEX flies in 2030, we will already have a list of targets that we can observe. And that's the way we are going to find an Earth-like exoplanet, I think.
And this I guess hits home for you, someone who's got a lot of passion towards the actual specific optics of finding these kind of things. You've mentioned a little bit about how it is hoping to be progressed over the next decade or so into 2030. Now, what are the limitations when we talk about viewing the galaxy? So, in my small idea of it, is it something as simple as we are limited by the size of the telescope? Is it something like if we could build the biggest telescope we could possibly make and put it into orbit, can we see everything in the universe? What are the limitations and how do you think that is actually going to progress throughout the future?
So it's multiple answers here. One thing is that if I'm just staying in the problem of exoplanet detection, because there is an answer for every scientific research we can do.
Right.
But for the exoplanet detection, we are trying to observe something which is extremely faint compared to a very bright object, the star. The planet is very faint and very close. So in this case, we need to have very good optics. Like when I say very good optics, I meant like we need to have mirror which is extremely well polished. We need to have mirrors and instruments which are extremely stable over time. Because as soon as you have a slight deformation of these due to change of temperature, due to the atmosphere, you name it, something, degradation over time, then your image will start getting blurrier and blurrier, and you can start seeing spikes, which are we are pretty on the picture, but they are awful for astronomers, because if your planet is exactly where there is those spikes, when I mean spikes, is, you know, when you look at a field of view, the stars are not tiny dots. Sometimes they have this kind of weird shape, like a spike. So people love those, but we hate those. Because if you have a planet exactly where the spikes is, you will never see your planet, right? So, and those spikes are introduced by diffraction problem issues into the optics. Spikes are one example. So we need to have adaptive optics, the famous technology I work for since 1996, but in space now. This is the famous technology that is composed of a small mirror, I call it a deformable mirror, that correct the atmospheric turbulences, but also correct aberration introduced by those optics. So the next generation of telescopes, the W1st, which is now called Roman Telescope, Space Telescope, and now ABEX, LUVOIR, those will have adaptive optics, because that's the only way we can detect exoplanets with those such a large telescopes.
You know, it's funny. I also did an episode, sort of a small history episode about Mars in general and some of the history of the viewing of Mars. And I discussed, you know, Schiaparelli's canals on Mars and how Percival Lowell felt about that and that kind of history. And it's funny that we are so, really so limited. It happens all the time in all aspects of science, but we are really so limited by the technology that we have, because that is a perfect example in which in the past, when astronomers were looking at the night sky, they didn't have photography. They had to wait for that 1 second of clear sky with no atmospheric turbulence in order to see something for the briefest second and sketch down the picture. And it's strange to think the comparisons that we have from then to now. And that's kind of a good segue onto what you want to speak about too, which is work you're doing with Unistellar and what you wanted to talk about with citizen science too. Now, all of a sudden, compared to even a few decades ago, presumably, people like normal folks like myself have the opportunity to purchase telescopes and to have an influence on the movement of astronomy. So could you tell us more about that?
Yes, this is a new project that I just started when we talked last time.
Oh, great.
So Unistellar is a private company which a goal is to democratize astronomy, make astronomy fun and accessible to everybody. And of course, as you know, if you observe with your naked eye, you don't see much, right? So if you want to do astronomy, you need a telescope. As you probably know as well, because I'm pretty sure you had a telescope or you have a telescope, that it's not an easy tool to use. No. If I give you a telescope, most people will not know where to point, what to observe, how to do the focus. And most people never go beyond trying to observe the moon and the planet, and that's done. And as I mentioned, there is millions of stars in our galaxy.
Right.
So if you do a
there's a lot to see.
Yeah, there's a lot to see, right? So this telescope, we basically invented what we call a digital smart telescope, the Enhanced Vision Telescope, the EVSCOPE. It's a telescope which is easy to use. And the way we designed this is basically by putting into a classical telescope, a Newtonian telescope of 4.5 inches aperture, so relatively small. You can carry it in a backpack. Mm-hmm. We put inside an electronic device, a sensor, and a computer on board, and you control it with a phone. Like everybody now has a cell phone, so why not using the cell phone to control your telescope? And it's smart enough, such as when you open the telescope, you set it up, you can tell him, hey, align yourself. So we use basically the technology that professional telescope had for years into this telescope. This telescope will look at the sky, and knowing the position of the observer and knowing the position of the time, and looking at the asterisms, we call that, it will know where it's pointing. Because stars are always slightly different, and we have basically a catalog of millions of stars on board the telescope, so you will always know where it's pointing based on this. And then when he's ready, aligned, it takes like a few minutes, not even, he will give you a list of targets you can observe. So knowing if you have a city, countryside, suburbs, etc., you can have a list of targets to observe. So you can have galaxy, nebulae, globular cluster, etc. And because he has a computer on board and a sensor, what you get, it's an image. Basically, a succession of images are being taken and stacked together to create a perfect image with a computer. So with this telescope, you can see galaxy nebulae in cities. I mean, I've done demos in Las Vegas. If you Google Las Vegas Orion Nebula, you will see that's kind of the most impressive thing I've done.
And as bright as possible too, right? In Las Vegas.
So you can see those beautiful bodies in the dark sky. And of course, if you go to the countryside, you see better. That's normal. You have better sky quality. But it's not only that. It's not only having fun. This is great because I really wanted to basically stop this. A telescope, it's very complicated, and you need to be very well skilled to know how to use it. With this telescope, it's not the case. You just, true, there is a learning curve of maybe a few days, but most people after a few days, they are able to observe anything they want, okay? But then we realized quickly that this telescope also has a potential to do scientific investigations. Mm-hmm. So we created programs with the SETI Institute to create scientific investigation. So we send alerts to our users so they know when there is an asteroid passing by, an asteroid occulting a star, or the planet that they can observe. Because with this tiny telescope, you can observe planets. Every time I say it, I'm still amazed by it. But that's the case. You can observe Jupiter-sized exoplanets transiting G-type stars. Wow. So that's like our sun. And we have hundreds of people who have been observing with this telescope and send us data. So every day when I wake up, I can see on social media pictures taken by people around the world. And I also, if I look at our server, I can see as well the number of observations taken by people around the world.
Wow.
Everywhere, in Australia, in Japan, in North America, in Europe. Now we are also in Chile, in Brazil, Hong Kong. It's kind of nice. If you go on our website, you see the map is growing slowly. There is more and more tiny dots. We have 5,000 of them now. So that's a big number.
That is a big number. And that sort of helps fight the issue that we were discussing earlier, which is how on earth when we have such vast numbers and sizes we're discussing, how on earth do you combat that? And I guess more manpower is the way to do it.
Exactly.
And one kind of beautiful thing as well is I've talked to a ton of physicists now, especially like astronomers, and for the most part, they all kind of have their own story of either the first time or the most influential time that they viewed the night sky, right? And even for myself, I remember at university, I'd seen through the most basic telescopes, but I remember when we had a half-decent telescope and we went out, and I remember first seeing like the rings of Saturn, like actually seeing the rings. Like you can see Mars on a clear night, the red sort of orb, but actually seeing the rings of Saturn, like I couldn't believe it was such a strange and alien moment for me. And for you as an astronomer, you doing these presentations with Unistellar and things like that, what influence have you seen, and what influence do you think it has giving normal people who are not necessarily astronomers the ability to see these ridiculous alien places far off?
What really amazed me is when I show a galaxy to people, like the Triangulum Galaxy, when I show that to them with the EVSCOPE, and they realize that they are seeing something first, that the light they're receiving was emitted 40 million years ago. Okay. And two, they are watching a galaxy which is composed of 100 billion stars. So there is suddenly this moment where they realize that, there is, the universe is huge. And those tiny dots that I'm seeing here are stars. And I think there were a lot of them. But when I look at the galaxy and I cannot count the star because there is so many of them, right, and I see this beautiful object, and I realize this is far away, but there is like worlds over there as well, probably planets. And a lot of people are getting more. One of the things that it changed in the mind of people is suddenly they realize that the vastness of the universe, and one of the question of are we alone, etc., come right away. This is kind of the moment where you have always this conversation about aliens, the possibility of life. Because maybe we can say that Earth is extremely rare, but there is so many galaxies and so many potential habitable worlds around in this galaxy that it's for sure there is somewhere else an intelligent species which is also asking the same questions. And maybe this intelligent species just invented the telescope and is pointing this telescope to us and wondering, what is this fuzzy thing? Is that a galaxy? It's kind of extraordinary when you think about it. There is this connection through the cosmos between intelligent species. And I think that's the thing we are bringing with this telescope.
Yeah. It's amazing how natural of a step it is for humans to immediately start thinking about these questions, right? In a sense that I guess other parts of science are not as intuitive. You know, if you're discussing things like the atom, it doesn't evoke that sort of same emotion, that same sort of human thing. And, you know, there might be some historical reasons, some biological reasons, but it's a pretty amazing perspective. And as we're getting to like the last 10 minutes or so,
I just wanted to say on this, that's the reason I become an astronomer. People often ask me, why are you an astronomer and not a biologist? And I always say it's because astronomy is a poetry of science. It's one of the few scientific topics that no matter what, people like it, they're interested, and there is always astronomy always have an impact on people. Like a beautiful pictures, these metaphysical questions of whether or not we are alone in this universe, the search for life, the colonization of planet. There is always some exciting topic of conversation here. And that's why I think astronomy is being talked a lot in the news, especially at the moment.
But what do you think that is? Honestly, why do you think, is it because there is some sort of, I remember I spoke to a physicist, Alan Duffy in Australia, and he said to me once, which is something that resonated with me, is when we start thinking about other worlds and potentially life elsewhere, it's because we're secretly wondering about us.
Yeah.
We're secretly, it's like if the dice was thrown and rolled another way, how could the evolution of our species have gone? Do you think that's kind of accurate?
I believe, and Jill Tarter mentioned that also multiple times, the true motivation of the research of SETI is not to know whether or not we are alone, is to know if we have a future as a species. Because as soon we will find out that there is other intelligent civilization elsewhere, we will realize that we are not an anomaly in this galaxy, in this universe. We will realize that there is a future as an intelligent species. Right now, we are not 100% sure that this intelligence is just a blimp into the evolution of species. So having this encounter of intelligence, another intelligent civilization will be great for us. We realize we are not unique, alone, and we also have someone to talk to, someone to learn from, and vice versa. And I think that's the true motivation of this research. We not consciously think about that, but I do. I personally think that it will, finding that we are not alone, we change radically the way us humans see ourselves. And we probably calm us down somehow, make us way more relaxed about what's going on and less aggressive. And you will see, there will be an impact.
There'll
and I hope
impact.
We're going to leave that, by the way.
Right. Right. Me too. It's going to be, you know, something huge to, yeah, I mean, there's going to be reverberations of it throughout all societies, no doubt, and something we've wondered for a long time. And one last thing that I wanted to discuss was, is kind of off that a little bit. You yourself, you know, you know, I guess, a lot about some of the differences of living or of the actual physicality of some of these worlds, for example, volcanic moons, icy planets, these kind of things. Now, we've talked mainly about these habitable planets because it reflects upon us as humans. However, what sort of width or breadth of variability of planets do you expect or at least have you witnessed?
Well, the more we learn about exoplanets, the more we realize they're extremely diverse. Mm-hmm. And we find exoplanets in places that we are not expecting. One of them was last year, the discovery of an exoplanet in orbit around a white dwarf. So the white dwarf is the end of life of a sun. Okay, after the red giant's phase, basically the envelope is being expelled, and we have what we call the core, which is the skeleton of the white dwarf. And by looking at a white dwarf with the TESS spacecraft, they discover that one of them had a Jupiter-sized exoplanet in orbit around it. Mm-hmm. And that's not something you were expecting, because you imagine that if there is an explosion like that, the entire system is destabilized and no planet. Well, there is a planet around this. This is the extreme case. This is like, we were not expecting that. We find exoplanets almost everywhere. There is some which are very cool, like the super habitable worlds, for instance. Those are exoplanets which seems to be slightly more massive than Earth, than our planet, so slightly more gravity, and they are wetter, slightly warmer. So they will have this kind of tropical climate, and they are on stars which are extremely old, like 10 billion years old, twice the age of our sun. So if there is life there, there will be a lot of life if this life is identical with us. Imagine an entire planet like Amazonia, for instance.
Right.
So we're discovering these extreme cases and places, the planet where we don't expect to see them. So, of course, there is a diversity of planet, and I'm betting that there will be, as soon as we have the instrument capable of finding life, we will find that there is also a diversity of life. What I mean with that is that the first life we will find will be probably like ours, because we are not crazy. As scientists, we need to get funding, so we want to quick discovery, right? So we're going to point the telescope toward the habitable planet, potentially habitable planet. But after a few years, maybe we'll find out there is life almost everywhere in this around this habitable planet. We will point this new instrument on those weird worlds, and we will find life maybe there, very different. Wow. That's going to be fun, because time will be different, the gravity is different, because, I don't know, there's so many things that could be completely
different.
So many variables.
Yeah, I had never heard of super habitable planets before, but that sends sort of a chill down my spine, because, you know, because as we've seen on Earth, it might be a bit anthropomorphic, but as we've seen on Earth, places, there are specific places that are bins of life that are just completely containing every variation of every species you can possibly imagine, and that's amazing to think that might be out there too.
Yeah.
Now, as a last point, as we're sort of rolling to the end of the podcast, there is one other thing that you said in the previous episode, which is another one of the points that many people sent messages about. And also, strangely, maybe for your information, I got both positive and negative messages, which maybe you might be used to. I'm not so sure. But you mentioned that humanity at the moment is sort of on this cusp where we're just really beginning to dip our toes outside of our home. A, and also that you were discussing astronomers are sort of like the cartographers of mm-hmm. the universe, and we're sort of building these maps and just starting to get an idea of what is outside of our comfort zone a little bit. Now, with keeping that in mind and also going off what you were saying before about the, I guess, the motivations of astronomy and why we do it, how do you feel and how do you think astronomy and humans' exploration is going to trend throughout the future? And we can talk on small scales like your lifetime, my lifetime, or even longer scales like 5 lifetimes or 10 lifetimes ahead. How do you think it's going to alter and what do you expect to occur?
Wow. Mm. That's an entire podcast series. So I do believe that there will be, and I share this with someone that you probably know by name, that humanity needs to escape the gravitational well of our planet. It's not because our planet is not a good planet, it's because mm-hmm. it's part of evolution to explore and to visit other worlds. So mm-hmm. we will. And people can say we should take care of Earth first, but there will be always some people who will stay to take care of Earth. But there will be always the pioneers who will decide to go in crazy missions and maybe go to Mars with a one-way ticket and try to live there. Or maybe they will simply live in those capsules somewhere also mm-hmm. trying to mine asteroids. We don't know. But I do believe that we are going to see that very soon, because there is the motivation, there is the technology to do that.
Mm.
And it's just a question of someone putting enough effort and resources to do it. Mm-hmm. The same way we built in Europe those ships to cross the ocean. And 0.00001% of the people wanted to go on these ships, but right. they did it, those. And then come back completely metamorphosed, telling stories about worlds that we did not even imagine, and they motivated a bigger group of people to go and to travel, like you and me and others now. So it's going to happen. And I mean, we can talk about planetary protection and saving the life we have on Mars if there is life, etc. But we will not be able, even as scientists,
mm-hmm.
be able to stop this, because that's no. natural evolution. So that's my take on the exploration of the solar system. Then the exploration mm-hmm. outside the solar system, that's a very big challenge. It's a challenge that we are not going to be able to solve now because of our biology. I think like those ideas of having a spacecraft that will travel for 400 years. If we find one day a way to go at a speed close to the speed of light, for instance, it will still take 100 years to go to Alpha Centauri, right? And if you go to Alpha Centauri, you go to a spacecraft for 100 years. You have this no gravity, there is radiation, etc. So when you leave Earth, you're not going to arrive there. That's going to be your offspring who's going to arrive there. And they will not be human anymore, because they will be completely changed by the environment into which they grew up. So how are we going to fix that? There are science fiction movies to tell us how to do it.
Right.
But one of the things that I think humans will have to do, and this is very controversial, and I know a lot of people will grab this moment, is by changing ourselves. Changing our genes, being those humans fully adapted to live in space.
Mm-hmm.
And once again, people say, no, I don't want to do that. But there will be always the 0.00001% of people who will be okay to do it, because suddenly they will have access to space. And I don't know how we're going to do this, but I do believe that our knowledge on biology and gene modification will help us to get to this moment where we can live fully in space in almost zero gravity or in very low gravity, or go to live on a very different planet with different type of atmosphere.
Well, Frank, I hope you made some people lose sleep again like you did the last time with some of the things you said. And I mean, yeah, it's something that I've discussed with a couple of guests in the past as well, the actual idea of changing ourselves. And although it might be an outlandish thing to say, we've certainly changed ourselves over the last 200 years when you talk about the way that we, you know, a smartphone has essentially made us a cyborg in so many respects, and even just things like the things that we use consistently now that we never used to, plastics, etc., etc. And maybe in 50 years when we're having another podcast, it might not be such a strange conversation. Now, thank you again. I appreciate your time. And if anybody is interested in what you have to say, they're interested in Unistellar as well specifically, where can they go to find out more?
So you can go to unistellar.com. We have a website. You can find information about the science we do with the network, the products, etc. Or you can also follow the SETI Institute. Go at SETI.org to find information about the search for life in the universe. Mm-hmm. That's what we do. Mm-hmm. 200 scientists crazy like me trying to answer to this basic question. Are we alone? And we all have different way of doing it. So.
Which makes it even better.
Yeah.
Okay, Frank, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Connor. Thank you for having me.
If you enjoyed what you listened to or have any feedback or just want to say hello, please help out by visiting the Blunt Report on social media, giving a rating, or even telling a friend about what you listen to. The podcast is available on all platforms, including video podcasts on YouTube, or can simply be found at theBluntReport.com.